This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Community focus. WEEI is proud to be part of the community. The following WEEI public service broadcast is brought to you by the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Community focus.
You're listening to Community Focus with Dr. Darnell Williams from the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Good morning, everyone. This is Darnell Williams, and I am your host here at the Community Focus program. And I'm so grateful to be back into the studio to bring what I call personalities and luminaries who come into the studio from across not only the city, but across the region and across the nation to give us information that will allow us to really understand what's going on. This week at the national level, there's been really, really challenging as we looked at the presidential debates. We listened to respond to the various tweets coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And there's been this tone of racism that really has disturbed us as a nation, but also challenged us on the morality front. Whether you're dealing with the folks telling the squad to go back to where they belong, if you're looking at Congressman Elijah Cummings from Baltimore talking about how Baltimore is a rat-infested city and that there's corruption there, these are not the words of healing, but these are words of divisiveness, but is on based on a color line. Then also there's a tweet that came out challenging Reverend Al Sharpton because of his criticism of the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So basically we have a quagmire. And I think the only thing that I would add in terms of the community focus, this is not based upon what a person says, but I've been in this country at least 6+ decades. I don't need for someone to write it. I don't need someone to convey it to me. I know what it's like when I'm being confronted with what I call inappropriate words that are not bringing us together as a nation. So gratefully, we have things that will offset that. But common sense is one of them. And so I think that when we think about when a person occupies a position, regardless of his or her politics, the thing that determines whether or not that you will end up being respected is how you bring us together as a nation rather than dividing us based upon some arbitrary line, whether it's your sexual orientation. There are many people across the spectrum that don't believe in same-sex marriages or relationships. There are another set of people who don't believe in interracial marriages. But we find them in my family and across the board in other people's family. Sometimes we have to just get over it and move on because we have so much more important work to do than to be in a situation where we're divided and people are looking at you out of the side of their eye or they want to say something to you that is inappropriate. But there's an old saying that says it doesn't what somebody calls me is what do I respond to? And, you know, say, I think there was another little phrase we said, sticks and stones may break my bones. But what was the other phrase, Ron or Al? But words will never hurt me. But those sticks and those stones hurt. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. So don't ever let words turn you from who you are. The scripture says it another way. It says, be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. That's where we should be in the nation, overcoming what we perceive to be evil, but not demonizing the person who may say things and do things that are contrary to your style, but overcome it. Let your good works overshadow them so that you are a positive addition to life. Our guest today is no stranger to doing good things. One of the things that I know, which I've heard over the years, that music will calm the savage beast. And there's a savage beast in all of us. And the reason that we keep the savage beast in a cage or a savage beast in a cage is called the tongue, not the tongue, but it's called the teeth. And if you close your mouth, the beast won't come out because you can't talk with your mouth closed. And that's why the mouth is there. So you're supposed to be doing twice as much listening as you are doing speaking. But let me turn to my guest. I want to say good morning, Mari.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We're so grateful to have you on. We have Mari Aronson on as our studio guest this morning. We're going to talk about Mari and what is it that he does and what he's been doing for a great length of time. But I want Mari to really give us a little sense. Mari, tell us, where do you hail from? I think you gave me the phrase that you were from Bloemfontein. I got it. I had it right initially. Bloemfontein.
Yeah,
Bloemfontein.
I was born in Bloemfontein, South Africa.
Yes.
And spent my first 19 years living there.
Okay, so yeah, you were a little tad when you were growing up in South Africa.
19 years, I was old enough to know good from bad.
Okay.
And the irony of Bloemfontein is that it's known for two things. It was it's known for more than two things, but the what I always found a sort of sweet metaphor is that it was the creation of the first Boer Republic. And so the architects of apartheid established their first republic when they moved from the Cape into the interior.
So they moved from Cape Town to...
Yeah, but the British drove them out of Cape Town. So you've got to be, you know, the British showed up and said, oh, no, we want Cape Town. It's going to be much better for us than you descendants of the Dutch.
Because they wanted to see the two oceans that come together down in Cape Town.
I think they want a little more than that.
But so, that's a beautiful view.
Right, yeah.
It's a beautiful view when you do see
those. It is. It's a magnificent view. And Cape Town itself is magnificent.
Yes.
So the Boers trekked into the interior, and that's where they established their first...
Republic?
First free republic. And in 1912, the African National Congress was formed in Bloemfontein.
Okay, so the ANC, as we would know it.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, it was probably formed there for symbolic reasons, because that was where the first Boer Republic was established. But I lived there for 19 years. I traveled around the world a bit for a couple of years. I went to college in Cape Town. I worked in Johannesburg and came over to Boston in the mid-80s.
Okay, so let's slow this train down for a minute.
Yeah, that's a quick summary. Well, 28 years.
We're going to peel back this onion just a little bit together, because you say that you were there for 19 years. Talk about your family life and maybe early influences in South Africa. Because you made a statement this morning that says that you knew in the 19 years what was the difference between right and wrong. So that is a... worth understanding of.
Right.
So let's talk about some early formative years, Mari, to talk about what is it that were some of your early influences or impressions of the Republic that was created. And before you answer that, tell us the proximity to where you grew up in relationship to either the Cape Town or to Joburg.
So Bloemfontein is New York, Boston.
Okay. Size-wise?
Same kind of distance.
Okay.
From each other.
That's about 2.5 hours, 3 hours.
Well, it's
about
like
200
a,
miles.
Yeah. It's like a 4-hour car ride from Johannesburg to Bloemfontein going south toward Cape Town.
Okay. Gotcha. So you're like, okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Geography-wise.
So, I mean, it's dry, it's hot, but the winters can be fairly chilly until the sun rises and warms up the ground. So, you know, when you grow up in what was then a absolutely and totally racially divided country, and you know from a fairly young age that something... if you have any kind of consciousness that something is not right, it doesn't take long to feel that and to see it. So I went to a high school, which was, well, I went to a school, and I actually stayed in the same school for 12 years, which you can consider it was a Christian national school. So you only got one.
Was that mostly whites?
Yes, whites only. Yeah, okay. Schools were segregated. Prior to the fall of apartheid, schools were segregated. Prior to the fall of apartheid, the country was segregated in every which way that
guess
you
what?
Can.
We got a lot in common.
Right, we do. No, we absolutely do. We have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
Except the difference is, in South Africa, the blacks were the majority, not the minority. So that's a...
They were the majority population. But they were the minority when it came to the mines,
to
the
anything,
ownership of the land.
To anything. To
government.
Minority, to anything. To,
okay.
to good education, to good living conditions, to good health care, to good transport, to good food, to everything.
Stop for a minute. So you're a white guy. You got mm-hmm. access. So how did you get a conscience?
Well, I think conscience starts with family.
Okay.
So I think that is where your consciousness starts. I grew up fortunately by I have sisters that are older than me. I was what's called I actually only know the South African word, but I was a late birth.
You were a late addition.
A late addition is what they say. A late addition over here. Okay, I was a late addition.
But you were in the mix.
So I was, my sisters were 11 years and 9 years older than me.
Okay, gotcha.
So if you have a sort of rite of passage in apartheid South Africa, which is you go to a school where you're taught one viewpoint, which is the at that point in time the nationalist government's viewpoint. So you're taught an Afrikaans viewpoint that
So you were taught from an Afrikaner.
Absolutely, absolutely. That
was the term. That's not. That's not that, a.
No, that's a term. It's a whites built this country. No one was really doing anything good before the Dutch or the British arrived as colonists, which is a fallacy.
Hold on. You have a great grasp of this 19 years, but I want to make sure that our listening audience who's listening to Mari speak really break that down, because oftentimes people gloss over very significant milestones. Here you are, tender age, 11 years younger than your sisters. You're being ushered into a system that is telling you to look at things one way, but something inside of your head and in your heart is telling you this ain't adding up. Two and two is not eight.
So one of my sisters, her name is Ilona. And when she went to college, she became very active in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa.
So she came involved in ANC early stages, or?
From the age of, she was probably 19.
Okay.
And with that came a re-education. I think you can look at that. A family re-education. No, this is what happened.
I see you laughing. That means that there were some contentious discussions at the table at your house.
Yeah, with my parents, but and I absorbed and soaked all this up. Although my parents themselves were not in favor of apartheid. The disagreement was, well, what's going to happen to my daughter when she enters this movement of struggle against the apartheid regime?
That's dangerous.
It's dangerous, and my sister did pay a price for that danger. That price was jail. Because she chose not to leave South Africa. Remember, there were people that fought within the country, and then there was the ANC in exile.
That fought
outside the country. And she stayed within the country. And her main job was working, she spent a lot of time working for an attorney by the name of Priscilla Jana. who in post-apartheid South Africa was a member of the cabinet, because she was an ANC member of the cabinet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this law office represented a lot of people that were being charged in South Africa for taking on the apartheid government and the apartheid laws. I mean, their most famous of clients, once he was on Robben Island, was Madiba, was Nelson Mandela. Yep.
Okay.
And so much so that I have a very touching story to tell, which is within the apartheid context. So my father passed away in probably like the late 80s. And Bloemfontein is a short distance from a town called Brandfort.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 80s, Winnie Mandela, Nelson Mandela's first wife, mm-hmm. was banished to this town called Brandfort. By banished, she was under house arrest in a godforsaken place where she was not allowed to have more than... I think it was two people in the same room with her at the same time. Apartheid laws...
Because they thought they were conspirators.
A resistance.
There's a resistance. Yeah. Okay, got it.
And when my father passed... When he was not allowed to leave this area. But when my father passed away, she sent her two daughters to pay their respects to our house
mm-hmm.
in Bloemfontein, which was a short distance away. And it's one of the most indelible memories I have, because I was about 21 at that time.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, I mean, this is what a gesture of graciousness and also respect to my sister for what she had done.
So your sister had paved the way and your parents had embraced it.
Yeah. Bear in mind, nobody wants to see their kid go to jail.
No.
You know, that's not an easy
That is more than just a high price of commitment.
Right.
That is a personal sacrifice that she believed fundamentally that apartheid was wrong. And many of the folks over here were fighting it as well in terms of divestiture.
And jail time over there generally for a political prisoner is solitary.
Yeah. Brutal.
Yeah. It's not easy. So, you know, I when I went to college, I went to the University of Cape Town, not every student. It was a white university. It did have a very small population of what one would and I'm talking apartheid classifications of coloreds, people of mixed race.
That was a description used by the hierarchy.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was stuff that would, when you think about it, it's like mm-hmm. who came up with this and how much and all the amount of time and effort that they spent into deciding what made you white and what made you colored and what made you black and you know what made you Indian.
Well, let me give you a news flash.
The Nazis used to what made Jews Jews.
Well, let me give you a news flash, Maury. They called us colored.
Right.
Before we were Negroes and blacks.
Right.
So it's the same pattern.
It's a form of derogatory.
That's right. That's right.
And it's as you were saying earlier on, sticks and stones
may break your bones.
Yeah. But names are a way of establishing you know, when you look at, as you mentioned, 1600 Pennsylvania, calling people out and calling people names, it's a way of separating them.
But it's also a way of degrading and making you less than.
Yeah.
So when people think about what they're saying to you, they want to be mean-spirited.
Yeah.
But your story is so fascinatingly connected to our African American experience, because I'm looking at you and you actually are from South Africa. I can call you an African American.
Well, I wouldn't call myself one. I mean, that's very nice of you, but, you know.
No, but I mean, the term, I've heard people from South Africa refer to themselves as African-American.
We have a different complexion, you and I.
But you have the complexion for the connection.
I'm connected to Africa. Like you said to me earlier before the interview started, it's the motherland.
That's right.
It's the motherland for me. It's the motherland for you.
All right. But I like your spirit, and the way that you are breaking it down is for people to understand that this was irreconcilable, not only in your head and in your heart. Your family paid the price, and then the story that you shared about Winnie Mandela sending her two daughters to pay respect to the loss of your dad. That's a story that will stay with me for a long time.
And it's stayed with me for my, clearly,
and
my
entire
family, it has stayed with them. Then I go off to university and, you know, you get involved
in
Cape Town, the University of Cape Town, which really, credit to the professors and the institution, but when you went to a university in Cape Town and you did a liberal arts degree, you were taught the real history of South Africa when you went to a liberal university. It wasn't an Afrikaans university.
Okay.
It was an English speaking.
So they took the rose colored tin glasses off
challenged the education and challenged you and gave you the critical tools to look at this education that you had gotten when you were 18 years of high school, and how do you reinterpret
what you've been taught?
Let's take the wars in the 1800s as the Boers trekked into the interior. First the wars against the Xhosa, and then the wars against the Sotho, and then the wars against the Zulu. So basically defeating and subjugating the indigenous people of South Africa.
Oh, because they wanted the resources.
Absolutely, but you're not taught that in high school, all right? You're not taught about the 1913 Land Act in high school and what its implications were. You are taught the history of South Africa that says this was a policy that started in the 1800s. The British are not to blame. Let's not put all the blame the British were, you know, they're complicit
The British has a lot of weight that's carried on because of the British Empire, and
they defeated the Boers in two wars. So let's talk. You know, you've got to put that in context, because when they defeated the Boers, they controlled the economy. These were wars about who's going to control those diamond and gold mines.
The diamond and golds, that's going to take us down a whole nother path.
Right,
we need to come back for four
Saturdays.
But I think that this is so great that you're able to break it down, because people can understand the nuances. It was about control. It's about land. It's about politics. It's about resources. And who is on top and who's on the bottom.
Right. And what education do you give people if you only want them to work in gold mines and be laborers? You don't give them a first-class education. You make sure that their education is inferior. So, you know, that leader of ANC's people, they got the education despite everything.
Right.
I mean, what incredible people. I mean, you know, to have, and those people spent how many years on Robben Island? Decades.
Yeah.
Decades on Robben Island.
Self-education.
Decades in exile. But never losing sight of the goal, which was a free and democratic South Africa. So, when you taught this history as a student, it's like another re-education that you go through. I mean, I had some from my family. Now I go through another one in college. But anyway, so in college you're involved in student politics. which, you know, at that time it was the beginning of an organization called the UDF, the United Democratic Front, which really was an internal wing of the ANC, which the ANC's sort of directive to the UDF was make the country ungovernable. So in order
to make it ungovernable.
In other words, through protest.
Basically to protest the breakdown of government.
Protest, boycotts, organizing labor, just strikes.
They borrowed the lessons from the civil rights movement.
Yeah, except there was they did, but at times it got very violent.
Yeah.
Because the South African government got very violent against
protests.
Because they tried to shut it down. Well, and they kill people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people died protesting. There are seminal points in the history of South Africa where you know, Hector Peterson, 76, the student that the first student that got shot in Soweto, protesting for a better educational system and an educational system that would not be in Afrikaans.
Right.
You know, Sharpeville. These are seminal points in our history. In the 80s, when the resistance got intense in the 80s, was, you know, state of emergency. So everybody lived through, like, the first state of emergency, the second state of emergency, where the government exercises extreme control over anything they declare to be, and I put this in parentheses, subversive.
I know. I can remember very clearly the name that we would listen and watch on the news, Pick Botha.
Oh, so he wagging was like, his finger at you? Do you remember that?
Of course I do. But the fact is, it may, as you said earlier.
Does it remind you of anybody?
Why do you think I opened up this conversation this morning about what was happening on the night? You think that was by accident?
If you've seen it once, you know what it looks like.
You know what it looks like. You know what it feels like.
Yeah.
And you know that you don't have to have somebody to write it down to tell you, because I've been here before. This is not my first rodeo.
Yes.
So the parallels are just so eerie.
Scary and eerie.
It's scary and eerie. And so this is just so mind-boggling that we thought that we had moved beyond that because we elected a black president, or we elected a black governor here in Massachusetts. But underneath, I know that there is something that is still in our DNA, that you're describing what your experiences are in South Africa to your family through what was going on, the violence of the government, the boycotts, the white nationalist whistle calls that are being made, the cat calls of the base, expanding the base. And so that base
taking it as, I can now walk into a church and kill people. I can walk into a church, into a synagogue, and kill people.
Movie theaters. Walmarts, wherever.
You know, that is...
crazy. No, we can't use the word.
It's not crazy.
No, it is serious.
It has serious implications, and it is a step and the beginning on a journey along a very dangerous path unless we as citizens stop this.
And I want to apologize for using the word crazy. That's an inappropriate term to use because there are people with real serious mental issues.
Yeah.
And crazy is one that really is a derogatory term. So I want to make sure that I don't ever use that again on the air. But there are people who are so fixated with the menu that's in their head or her head that they want to cause harm to people because somebody's fed them a bogus narrative about what life is. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement, yeah.
So you got all of these experiences swirling around in your head, and so you're 19, now you're college educated.
Yeah, and I'm done with college, and I'm in the 80s, and I'm working for a wonderful organization in South Africa called Kaya, which is the Zulu word for home.
Okay.
And it's a cultural organization, and the sort of core business is touring live black musicians. And I have to use, we are in apartheid South Africa, so I have to I have to determine the difference between white and black, because the black music experience is totally different to the white music experience at that time in South Africa.
They could not perform on a stage, and the audiences had to be separated as well,
exactly,
if I remember correctly.
And they could, ironically, and this is another one of those crazy apartheid laws, they could perform at a hotel bar in white South Africa. Don't ask me why. Okay. It's just really bizarre. But it was one of those crazy laws.
We got some stories that can match right. that. Be sure to tune in next week when we will continue this conversation right here on 93.7 WEEI.
Community Focus. Thanks for listening to Community Focus with Dr. Darnell Williams. Be sure to tune in next week for another segment of Community Focus.
Community Focus.
This is Sports Radio 93.7 WEEI and WEEI.com, Boston.
Community Focus.
WEEI is proud to be part of the community. The following WEEI public service broadcast is brought to you by the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Community Focus.
You're listening to Community Focus with Dr. Darnell Williams from the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Welcome back to the conversation on the Community Focus program. My guest today is Maury Aronson, who is Global Arts Live, and we're so grateful to have him in the studio, a man of worldliness, but also a touch of melody that just makes us great, not only for the listening audience, but for me personally as well. Now, Maury Aronson, you have been really describing, we haven't even got to it, but I think this is the juncture got you into the work that you've been doing. So thank you so much for walking us through your fundamental development, your conscious raising, but you're also with your sharing what the South African experience was. You were talking about you went to go work for this cultural organization that was really, and you made the distinction between white musicians and black musicians.
Because it's apartheid South Africa, and there are two various different structures for it.
And what's the music? What's the difference between the music?
Well, the difference is there's black radio and there's white radio. and there's venues where you can play if you're black.
You can listen to it.
But never mind that there's black radio and white radio. There is Sotho radio, Zulu radio, Xhosa radio, Tswana radio.
I know.
There's
no cross blend.
Right. Now it's taken and divided along language as well.
Remember,
the architects of apartheid want to keep the indigenous people of South Africa separate as well. This is where the Zulus have a homeland. This is where the Tswana have a homeland. This is where the Xhosa have a homeland.
Maury Aronson is here. He's a Global Arts Live founder. You're the founder. I thought you were co-founder in there with my raising. But you're the co-founder. This is just so fascinating, Maury, that you are giving us this. You're walking down the memory lane.
Yeah.
But then this cultural organization, you said it was called Home.
Yeah, Kaya.
Kaya?
Yeah.
How do you spell Kaya?
K-A-Y-A.
Okay, Kaya.
And working in, now listen, I'm a white guy, but I'm spending my life in the townships.
I can't call you brother?
you can. But I'm trying to get back to the South African experience.
Yes, sir.
I'm a white guy
in
the townships.
Mm-hmm.
Touring with black South African musicians. So I'm spending most of my time on the road. So in this time of the 80s, we are touring, and this is the power of culture. And this is when I had this lesson deeply instilled in me. No matter what is going on around you, culture, music, is an incredibly powerful tool to talk and to bring people together. Because despite all of this chaos, and the only way to describe it is chaos in the 80s in South Africa, because the townships are a center point of resistance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are boycotts going on of any kind you can imagine. Boycotts, let's say a government building, which is a shed, like they own a hall. It's government controlled. If you're into a homeland, it's government controlled.
Mm-hmm.
There's boycotts
mm-hmm.
of those halls. You cannot play them.
You cannot do what?
You cannot perform.
You can't perform in the government building.
Right, because it's a symbol of the government.
Right, because in other words, they don't want you to give any messages.
Any credibility to the government
that
at all.
That we are agreement. Now, you can sing what you want to sing, but you ain't going to sing it here.
So there's this, and it's violent in the townships at that time because it's a point of conflict.
Has it changed since the reconciliation?
Well, it's changed in the sense that it's not state violence. The violence at that time I'm talking about is state violence.
It's state violence versus tribal violence.
Or just people in poverty, still a lot, you know, people stealing things and criminal violence and murder, which we have throughout the world. This was state violence upon the people of South Africa.
In order to beat them down, to make them feel that they were less than... And their rights were not to be respected.
Right, because they are. Remember, the UDF, as I said, is now trying to make the government, the city, the country ungovernable. And they're doing a really good job at it.
Okay,
You know, South Africa didn't decide one day in 1990. When was it? 91, 92. De Klerk didn't wake up one day and decide, oh, I'm going to give up power to the majority of South Africans. It happened because there were so many.
And white South Africans were afraid because they thought that when the blacks got in control, they were going to come after them.
But that was the propaganda of the white government.
Gotcha.
It was. They actually had a word for it.
What was that?
And I will translate it. The word was swart gefaar, which is black danger.
Okay.
So if you translate it, and this was propaganda.
Yeah.
This was what you said. If we give power to the majority of South Africans, they're
going
to.
Which is 80% of black.
They're going to come out and kill us.
Yeah, that sounds like the Willie Horton commercial in 88 when Dukakis ran.
So, you know.
Hands going to take your job.
So, change did not happen because anybody, the white regime, you know, the apartheid regime was benevolent or wanting to. They were forced.
No, but they also had some economic pressures from across the globe
that really forced them to change. There was a divestment movement.
That's right.
There was cultural boycotts. There were economic boycotts. There were just so many different boycotts. But I want to go back, if I can.
You can.
Because I think we...
Yeah, yeah.
To my early cultural education.
Organization.
And an organization.
Kaya.
Yeah, Kaya. And it taught me that anything is possible, everything is possible, regardless how difficult the circumstance. And I have taken that lesson with me and applied it to the establishment of what was 30 years ago World Music, and our name has changed now to Global Arts Life, but we were known as World Music, and then we were known as World Music Crash Arts, and we now changed our name to Global Arts Live. So when what happened was, I was, without getting too involved in it, I was part of I was affected by a particularly violent
incident,
and I needed a break, and I went into my Kaya. By the way, is black owned.
Okay.
So I need to say that in terms of apartheid South Africa.
Okay.
Okay. So my boss.
So you were immersed into black culture.
Yeah.
That's basically what you're telling me.
My boss was a person by the name of Koloi Lebona, better known as Bra Ka, a blind South African musician who became the finest record producer of traditional South African music. Just the finest producer. And an incredible guy. And
thank you for sharing.
Right. And he had white partners in the business, but it was a black-owned business.
But I think that's so important for people to understand that you have been transformed because of this cultural experience.
You know, I've never looked at it that way. I've only looked at it this really, and I think you have a good point, but it shaped me.
We call it transformation, Maury. Right.
Okay. I thought transformation only happened after 94 in South Africa.
That's called reconciliation.
So anyway, so I had this break and I got on a plane like within 2 weeks and I arrived in Boston. Get out of here. Yeah, I had a friend.
Why Boston?
Because I had a friend who was doing a master's at MIT.
Okay.
And a friend who was also involved in the anti-apartheid movement.
As an exile, or is
he went back?
He went back.
He went back to Zimbabwe.
Okay.
Because he couldn't go back to South Africa; they wouldn't let him.
No, because that means he would have been in further danger.
And he was a documentary filmmaker.
Okay.
So, and he was doing a master's at the Media Lab.
Okay. MIT.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. And he said to me, "Hey, you know, I'm going back. I'm going to go to Zimbabwe. I'm going to work from Zimbabwe." And my apartment was this rent-controlled apartment in Central Square. And he said, "You want to stay? This apartment's yours." I said, "Really?" I mean, I said, "Okay, this sounds good."
Wait a minute. You just landed in Cambridge.
Right.
I'm sorry. You landed in the Republic of Cambridge.
Right.
With a rent-controlled. He's from Cambridge, so that's why he's laughing at me.
He says to me, "There's actually a filmmaker in Boston that wants to do a documentary on South Africa, and you're perfect for it because you know both culture and politics."
Oh, get out.
Yeah. I said, "Really?"
And I get paid for it, too?
And I got a visa. That's a sweet deal. So I was like, "I can work legally. I get paid. Okay, I'll do this because, you know." So I went back to South Africa. I think we spent 6 weeks there with this filmmaker, and it was a difficult time because I was very nervous because we were now filming where you were not allowed to film. Okay, point blank, you were not allowed to film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you could not film. What was going on in the townships from resistance and violence. They're going to arrest me, throw me in jail, but she's going to leave. That's fine.
Let me ask you this question, though. When you're saying that you were doing that, where this is more predominantly in the black areas where the violence from that state-sanctioned violence that was being carried out, and you guys were filming that.
Yeah.
And you captured that in order. What was the main motive behind capturing it?
She produced a mixed media installation, which was very good. And if I remember correctly, it was called South African Tapes Living in a State of Emergency. And it toured as an installation in the United States. This is probably the late 80s. This is before the end of apartheid.
Okay.
So sometime in the late 80s. And so I stayed. Here I am. And I then got another job.
Still here in Boston?
Still here in Boston, working for a dance company. And I learned about nonprofit performing arts organizations in that. Remember, I really, honestly, didn't have a dime to my name when I arrived here. I'm being just real honest. I'd like $100 in my pocket.
You had more than many of us.
Right. So I then worked for this dance company, mm-hmm. and then I decided, and I, the first thing I did when I moved here was I was a soccer player for many years, and mm-hmm. I played deep into my 30s. And the first thing I found was a soccer team. Soccer in those days was very different to what it is these days. Now it's a very popular game in the suburbs, and a lot of kids, more kids are playing soccer than I think are playing football, just because it's a much more popular game for youth sports. But at that time, when I'm in my late 20s, all the teams are immigrants.
We grew up in the Pele era.
Right, right. So you know what I'm talking about. I'm playing with Cape Verdeans. I'm playing with guys from Latin America. I'm playing with guys from South America. I'm playing with Russians. I'm playing with a lot of Cape Verdeans.
Yeah, you're playing with the United Nations.
Exactly. And I'm playing with guys from the Congo, what was then Zaire, the DRC. Yeah. I mean, a lot of – so anyway, and I'm – then we're talking and we're going, "Hey, what about – and we're talking about music and we're talking about – you know, what we can't see." And I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to start this organization that is going to bring the music of the world to Boston." And this was in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And people often say to me, "Well, how did you, like, do your sort of what was called, like, marketing outreach?" I said, "The soccer players."
I think that's awesome. So they became your media.
Yeah, well,
they became your social media.
Like, if you're bringing somebody from the DRC, why not, well, which was then called Zaire, why not ask somebody from Zaire, who would you like to see? So it was a very different time. It was pre-digital age. Let's get this all in perspective. Everything was, you know, you were going from vinyl to cassette tape to DVD. And it was pre-internet. So everything that you did in, you know, you needed to meet people. You needed to talk to people. You needed to get to know people. And so that's when we started. And I actually started with a South African music festival.
Okay.
Because that's really what I knew. And it consisted of Ladysmith Black Mambaza, who had just been on the Paul Simon Graceland tour.
That's right. And that was so beautiful. Yeah. The music that they do is just phenomenal.
And they are the only group that we have presented every single year since 1991. And every single year, I'm talking every single year, they have sold out their concert.
Yes.
Just because they are so good.
They're so
now,
good.
Now, I want to tell you just a quick story about what the word Ladysmith Black Mambaza means.
Okay.
It means the axe of Ladysmith, which is the town where they came from. And they got that name because they sing a style called Mbube, which is vocal South African singing. And they got that name from all the contests that they would win. They got the name The Axe of Ladysmith because they mowed down the competition. No one could beat them. So that's the name. But anyway, that's another story.
No, man. But that is so powerfully resonating because when you listen to them, they're so inspirational and aspirational in their music. It just moves you.
Absolutely moves you. So we started with that, and then very quickly we started presenting music from all over the world.
Okay.
And then we started presenting contemporary dance in the early 2000s. And we had this mix now of music. And then as you were talking about Diane Reeves earlier on.
Yes.
We started presenting jazz. And people came to us, really, and I didn't start calling jazz artists. Their managers and agents started calling me.
Calling you.
Because
okay.
they saw us taking risks with these unknown artists.
Okay, gotcha.
That we were bringing from all over the world to Boston. And they were saying, okay, this guy, he's got an appetite for risk. let's give him a call.
Okay.
So what I'd like to say, we always try to fill a place where the need was needed. So the art was needed, a place, a platform to give these incredible artists a stage to share their art, their message, their vision with the people of Boston. So if you want to really just take what we are today, Global Arts Live, we present inspiring performances that feature artists from all over the world that inspire, transcend borders, and create community. Right now in this history of where we are in this country,
we
hope that the cultural message is a bridge of understanding that basically is a rejection of the dogma that is coming out of, as you said, the address 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The United States, it's not a country without problems and without its own struggle and without its own history. Mm-hmm. But it's a pluralistic country. You know, I mean, where we are today, this is a country of immigrants.
Oh, it clearly
and
we
this
are.
Is a country, yeah. if you, and this is a in where people, these artists that we present, let's just take for an example, like the Pedrito Martinez group. Okay, he's a Cuban, but living in New York City, the world's best conga player. Really, he's an absolutely incredible
percussionist.
Just incredible. Sao Jorge, Brazilian. We have a massive Brazilian population in Boston. I'm talking massive. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. you know, I kid you not. It's in excess of 300,000 people. Carminho, Portuguese. We have a huge Portuguese population
in
Boston.
Yeah, the Cabo. I think there's one artist in your lineup that has replaced the Cabo diva that passed away.
Yeah, well, Cesaria, and that is Lucy Bella.
Yes, sorry.
And and the Cape Verdean population, in as you know, in Boston, in Dorchester, in Roxbury, in New Bedford, is huge.
Oh, and they follow their cultural.
It's like they could still be living in Cabo Verde. I mean, they know exactly who's hot in Cabo Verde.
That's right.
And so do the Brazilians know who's hot in Brazil.
And then you have Venezuela.
And so do the Congolese people from DRC know who's hot in the DRC.
You have someone from Venezuela, from Margarita.
Yeah, Nella. Was a Berkeley graduate.
Okay.
So, you know, our concerts bring people together.
That's so powerful.
It's a shared experience of culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
And we hope, it's a shared experience of culture for people. Yes, if you have a strong immigrant base in Boston, Cape Verdean, Brazilian, there's going to be 90% of that audience is Cape Verdean or Brazilian.
Well, you made a statement earlier, and I want to remind the listening audience that you're listening to Mario Aronson, who is from Global Arts Live. He's been really breaking it down for us. But one of the things that you said that really triggered a thought in my head here is that if I can go to Ireland, but I would never become an Irish citizen. I can go to Europe. I can go to England. But I can get a passport and all of that, but I won't be British. But I can go to Italy, but I won't become Italian.
Mm-hmm.
America is the only place that where you can go from all of these places and become American. That's why the French gave us the Statue of Liberty as a gift to welcome all the people from give me your tired, your poor, yearning to be free, yearning. So we'd be freedom from religion, freedom from want, freedom from religion. All of those freedoms that we fought for, I think there was four that FDR quoted. My point is that America is a nation of immigrants, 2 to 3 generations, all of them. So we're the only ones who came on the ship that was, we didn't have the
right. If we're not there yet,
mm-hmm.
this is very close to what is called a minority, but the minority now is very close to the majority.
I don't want to do a shout out, but yay!
Yeah, and this is what I think the reaction is to the base right now.
It's white fear.
That's
bottom line. The same thing the South Africans went through when.
This is basically the
make
statement.
America great again.
Right. The statement. Who made America great in the first place? I thought America was great anyway.
Well, because we built it. And
right.
But the white folks who were on top, just like they were in South Africa, they are fearing the grip because the population is shifting.
Right. The statement.
Demographic.
The statement to the squad.
Right.
To go back to your countries, for God's sake.
I came from Detroit.
Right. you know, really.
I came from Chicago.
Right. I mean, it's... anyway, so this is a immigrant country. I hope it always is, because immigration is the rock bed, the foundation of the United States of America. It really, if you walk around... Let's take Boston. Let's take New York City. Let's take L.A. I haven't been to a lot of cities in Middle America, so I can't really talk for that.
I have. I can. And so you, whatever you miss, I'll pick it
right,
up.
But you walk around there, you could be anywhere in the world.
Right.
You know, and if you go to the music that's coming out of New York City right now from immigrants... But first-generation immigrants,
mm-hmm.
people from Pakistan, whose parents were from Pakistan, whose parents were from Colombia, mm-hmm. whose parents were from Brazil, It's like a hotbed of creativity.
We need to make sure that you tell Mari Aronson is here. Tell people what your website is,
okay,
so they can go and find all of these, because you have lineup here all the way into next year.
Yes, we've got about, I think, 39 concerts, 40 concerts up on our website right now, and we'll be adding plenty more.
Okay.
The website is www.globalartslive.org. globalartslive.org.
And you have a phone number?
617-876-4275.
Well, I can just say this to you from my standpoint of view, man, you've done a world of good in terms of our humanity, starting out with that rent-controlled apartment in Cambridge Square.
I didn't tell you what the bathroom looked like in that rent-controlled apartment. It was one of those where there was no wall. There was just like a piece of, you know, what you keep windows warm with in the winter? That was the wall. I said to the landlord, is it okay if I fix this?
So you took that $100 and now you've leveraged it. And you, but you know what the beauty of your story is? Is that you have not walked away from any of your experiences. They have really made you into the person that you are, and you're a gift to mankind, my friend.
Well, look, I really appreciate that, but without the support of the people of Boston,
yes,
without the support of all the artists that we have presented, and we have presented over 1,500 artists. That's a lot of artists.
And you've served over a million people.
Yeah,
so yeah. I tried to do a little homework.
Right. So actually, I think we presented 1,500 concerts and 700 artists. Without the support of the people that embraced us, without the support of all the immigrant communities around Boston, and without support of the wonderful artists that we bring to Boston, it's really a lot of it is because of them and their giving and their goodwill and coming to a concert. And I honestly do believe that when you come to one of our concerts,
mm-hmm,
you will come again because you feel you are part of a community.
And I think that's so vitally important, because I think one of the messages that when we started out, we talked about the division and the hate, the racism, the xenophobia, the misogynist thoughts, the degradation of people. All of those things that is describing the narrative of where we are, that's gripping our nation. And what you're offering is the music from all walks of life and all different kinds of folks that are bringing this to bear, that really gives us a chance to escape from the, and I think here's the phrase that you use, regardless of the circumstances going around me, we're able to bring this to the table where culture and the powerfulness of the message of the music. Is that?
That
I think
is
that's
correct.
What I just heard
and
you
we
say.
Are, and we are all the same.
Yeah. You know? You take the layer of skin off and I think we're flesh and bone and blood.
And yeah. And basically, you don't, in order to appreciate, let's just, for example, a Pakistani artist.
Yes.
Who's singing in Urdu. You know, I don't speak Urdu, but I can still appreciate the art of this artist, because once I'm there, this artist is moving me in a way. You talk about transformative.
Yes.
When you go to an exceptional performance, we've all been there, and you're going, oh my God.
So
this guy has taken, this artist has taken me
and transported
to another place.
Another place.
I leave this with a different understanding, with a different viewpoint, with absolutely feeling really good that I experienced this.
And you know what you've just said is really, that's what we need. That's the answer. It's the aspiration, it's the vision, it's the connectivity, it's the intersectionality of where music will really touch your heart and your spirit. Because you made a statement earlier, you said it changed you. So how can this vehicle help us change America so we can get beyond this race issue that we're dealing with?
Come to a concert,
Come to a concert.
Yeah, I mean
and come to another concert.
You will be part of a community where people around you all look different, but you're all the same.
Okay. Sounds like a good variety salad to me.
Right. It's America.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Mm-hmm, it is simply America. And this is the America that most people in the last election voted for. The popular vote last year, last election.
In 2016.
In 2016.
That was a 3 million vote difference.
Yes.
So
more people
vote.
Voted for the America that we would like to see.
Right. And but we inherited was the belly of the beast. And so we're really going to have to dig ourselves out of this. So tell the people your website and your contact number again.
Once again, it's Global Arts Live.
www.globalartslive.org
617-876-4275.
You have been listening to Mari Aronson, who is the founder of Global Arts Live, who was originally from South Africa, Cambridge, 1980s, been doing this work for 30 years. You owe it to yourselves to become part of a global community where he is really transforming, where the artists from all over the world are coming here to transform and help us. Mari, if you had any final words that you want to share with the listening audience, what would that be?
Go out, see a concert, participate in a cultural activity, and that could be with your friends at home listening to good music and dancing.
But you couldn't ask anything better than that. And this is Darnell Williams. I am your host. Dr. D is on the mic. I'm saying go out and have a blessed day. I want you to have a blessed week and go to a concert.
Community Focus.
Thanks for listening to Community Focus with Dr. Darnell Williams. Be sure to tune in next week for another segment of Community Focus.
Community Focus.
This is Sports Radio 93.7, WEEI and WEEI.com, Boston.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.